Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Joe Alalu. Joe is the co-founder and managing director of Daring Ventures. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Excellent. So why don't we start with Daring Ventures? What's the firm's investment thesis?
Yeah, so at Daring Ventures, we are a true pre-seed fund. We invest anywhere from idea through early commercialization. And we have a focus on B2B software that helps scale human moats.
And let's start with human moats. How do you define it?
Yeah, so software historically has always helped people do things. And there has always been opportunities to use software to automate some of the things that are rote, inefficient, et cetera. And I think we're in a really exciting time right now with large language models, machine learning, generative AI, whatever it is that you want to call it. There's a lot of opportunity for a new class of work. One of the things that people really generally refer to as knowledge work, for that to be automated. And while we see that there is a lot of opportunity to automate some types of knowledge related work, there's other places where human friction actually is more of a feature than it is a bug. So, you know, to give you a really loose but informative example, one of the places where we've been spending a little bit of time is in hospitality tech. And, you know, remember, at a Michelin star restaurant, like 11 Madison Park here in New York, you know, if you were just going to look at that through the lens of, is this efficient, yes or no? The answer is far and away, no, this is not efficient at all. Yet we still show up to do it. So that, you know, it just kind of illustrates one of the places where we see human friction as feature, not just bug.
And so as you start to look at different portfolio companies that make an investment decision, where are you seeing a great interaction between human friction and artificial intelligence?
Yeah, so we divide the world into five buckets, for in terms of industries or sectors. And we see it as advisory, essential, experiential, complex, and hazardous. Complex and hazardous, we do not invest in, but we invest across business functions in advisory services, essential services, and experiential services, because these are the three areas where human judgment, human connection, and human curation serve a really, really important role. So those are the places that we invest in. And, you know, a little bit more specifically, one of the places where we, like I mentioned, have seen a tremendous amount of synergy is in hospitality and other experiential sectors. Somewhere else that we have been spending a lot of time focusing on is professional services, specifically financial services, things, tools to support other types of white collar work, including accounting, marketing, things that are in the, that are a little bit more creative in nature. We think that those are places where human relationships are actually the real main driver of value, and automating things away misses the point about why people engage in those things. You know, I was a former investment banker, and many of the things that junior bankers do can easily be automated away. But the one thing that can't really be automated is the managing director's network and their ability to pick up the phone and call the head of corp dev bunch of different shops, call managing partners at a bunch of different private equity firms and ask them what they're seeing in the market, what they're looking for, and how to make a deal. That's something that can't be automated away. Something else to touch on is an idea that we call process as product. One of the ways that junior bankers, for example, learn deal mechanics and become people who are senior relationship managers and relationship driving bankers, which is what the senior roles are, is they learn that by getting reps. And that doesn't necessarily mean learning the ins and outs of financial modeling or, you know, learning specific shortcuts in Excel or PowerPoint, but it's about seeing how deals unfold. That's the only way that you're ever going to get knowledge about what it is that bankers do. So we see it as banks doing more deals with the same number of bankers than banks doing the same number of deals with fewer bankers. That's kind of an example of how we think about the value of AI in professional services, and that maps across all the different sectors that we invest in.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So, you know, as I shared with you before, call our firm does accounting and finance. And we have an engineering team which is devoted to automation. But it's been clear to us since day one that there's no eliminating the human from the loop, because at a minimum, you know, AI can't infer intent. Notwithstanding the fact that accounting is a bit complicated, and while there are underlying premises that are same from client to client, you know, there's a unique profile that exists. And to think that you can put everything in, you know, one size fits all, maybe one day, I think we're far from it. And so I think your thesis is absolutely spot on. And I also like what you said too about how, you know, you're distinguishing between co-pilots and agents. I agree. I think they both have a place in professional services, whether it's hospitality, law, accounting, finance. Because yes, there are definitely some rote processes. I love the reps comment. I think there are definitely opportunities to help shorten the learning curve, but you still need judgment. I don't know that. I think we're very far away from escaping that. You mentioned your time as an iBanker. I know you were at Lazard. Can we take a step back? We'd love to know what your career progression looked like and how it led to Darren.
Yeah, it's a question that I both love answering, but only after having to answer that question. I did not take a traditional path to this point. You know, a lot of people look at me on LinkedIn, they see that I graduated Columbia undergrad, did investment banking at Lazard, and now I'm starting my own venture fund. And they kind of put me into a box, so to speak. But you know, I'm far from anything that anyone would expect. I came to this point really after having to pull myself up by the bootstraps. I did not get into any colleges after high school. In high school, I was, you know, like a lot of young men, very immature. I leaned into the things that I enjoyed, which was my friends, playing soccer, hit my history class, and I leaned out of basically everything else, which was, you know, responsibilities, homework, etc. And I found myself in a position when all my friends were going off to college, I had, you know, I was left empty-handed. And, you know, I tried community college because I felt like it was something that I needed to do. I didn't have a real why to be there. And community college is not a hospitable place for somebody who doesn't have a why. I dropped out. I was in and out three times, and I ended up moving across the country to California. I moved in with my grandparents, and I was just looking for something to do, which turned out to be washing cars at Enterprise Rent-A-Car. And you know, that was a tough moment. I was looking around again. All my friends were, you know, Big Ten schools, frat parties, football games, consulting internships, and there I was scrubbing cars. And I ended up, I needed to get another job. This country's not a great place to be if you don't have a lot of money and if you don't have a college education. And I had neither. So I needed to get a second job. And I got an indoor job, working basically as I was a front desk, mailroom, office running person at a boutique investment bank in Los Angeles. I had no idea what to expect when I got there. I didn't know if I was going to find a trading floor or if I was going to find tellers or what. But what I did find was a bunch of kids around my age, early 20s. They looked like they were having the time of their life working super hard and hanging out with each other and messing around in the bullpen. And I basically decided right then and there that that's what I wanted to be when I grew up. And in my infinite naivete, I started telling people that. And to that point, they would tell me, first of all, you're already grown up. And second of all, people who drop out of community college don't get to become investment bankers. And I finally had a why. Applied myself at Santa Monica College, community college out in LA. Did well on my standardized tests, and I was fortunate enough to get the opportunity to transfer to Columbia, and then from Columbia off to Lazard. So, not a particularly normal path, you know, for somebody who has a particularly typical and normal looking resume. I spent so much time trying to buff all of those little like dings and scrapes and stuff out of my resume and try to make myself look as plain vanilla as possible, because that's something that's really rewarded in a lot of in a lot of circles in finance. But ultimately I decided that that was not authentic to me and not authentic to who I really was. I started really leaning into that non-traditional background, and that's how I came to love answering that question.
Well, kudos to you for being candid. I thank you, appreciate it. And I agree. I mean, you know, I don't, yeah, I'm sure there's lots of people who follow the traditional path, but you know, on the flip side, I think the other way to look at it is there's been a lot of successful investors who've had unorthodox paths. You know, and the thing about what you've achieved, and now you're co-founder, general partner of Daring Ventures. Congratulations. I mean, that's amazing. So with that, you know, how has that path influenced your investing style today? And, you know, did you look at founders different? Do you look at technology different? Would love to hear how it's influenced you.
Yeah. So one of the things that I did prior to starting Daring Ventures was I used to run this program called Wall Street After Community College. For all the finance buffs out there, we chose WAC as our acronym. And we basically made the commitment that we were going to be there for you from day one of your associate's degree to day one of your summer analyst position. Because I realized after spending some time at community college and then spending some time at Columbia, there's a huge socioeconomic divide between people who know about careers in investment banking, front office Wall Street positions, and those who don't. It was so apparent to me when I was doing I was running the SMC Investment and Entrepreneurship Club at Santa Monica College. And I would talk about like, hey, okay, like, you know, we're all going to do prep for banking. And people would come in like, investment banking, Wolf of Wall Street's my favorite movie. Or like, I love investment banking. Like, I know everything about crypto. And I was like, okay, that's not what investment banking is. But if you want to learn, I'm more than happy to teach you. So I came up with this program WAC where I was going to help kids, learn about that stuff. And first it started with, well, I'm just going to do some info sessions. And then it turned into like, okay, maybe I'll do a few resume reviews. And then next thing I know, I was running cohorts on Google Meet on Saturday nights. This is what I did with my one kind of day off in banking. I was running these cohorts, 8 week long programs over the summer, with curriculum that I built, helping kids get all the tools and skills and knowledge and everything that they needed. And then I call up my friends at other banks and personally vouch for these kids. This is not scalable. This is not sustainable. But I would call, I'd call up my friends and be like, hey, like I got this guy. It says he's at community college. He's transferring to UCLA. I promise you, if he like bombs the interview, your VP or your managing director can like smack me in the face in front of everybody. This is how confident I am that this kid is going to crush. And it was extremely rewarding, but more importantly, it really informed now my investment style, which is looking for those diamonds in the rough, right? Looking for those people who have what it takes, who may not necessarily be in the normal channel. And I call it, reading between the lines on the resume, right? I think a lot of the best founders, the same way that a lot of the best, kids I had in my WAC cohorts, they don't jump out off, their resume is not going to blow anybody. You have to read between those lines and look for the little tells. What is this person's secret sauce? And it's usually, what is their relationship with adversity? Because that's the thing that I found with a lot of students at community college that I find also today with a lot of founders. They have a very, very strong relationship with adversity. They have had to deal with a lot. And conversely, there's a lot of people out there who have never really heard no before in their life. And maybe, Harvard said no, but Yale said yes. Facebook said no, but Microsoft said yes. Goldman Sachs said no, but Morgan Stanley said yes. There's a lot of people who have not had to fight and claw. And those people, I don't believe that they make good founders because Mr. Market is not very nice. Mr. Market doesn't care. And you know, capitalism is, it's a ruthless meritocracy. And that was one of the ideas that I really developed when I was running WAC, is who are the people who, when their back is up against the wall, they're not going to quit because they literally do not know anything else. And that's really informed a lot of what we are investing in, or how we're investing in the founders that we invested here at Daring Ventures.
Yeah, so it's brilliant, and I think you're spot on. You know, I talked to a lot of investors, and obviously a big emphasis on technical capabilities of the founding team. But you know, close second, if not tied, is you know just grit, and you know being a founder is really hard. And it requires thick skin. It's an emotional roller coaster. And yes, I think definitely some of the more successful founders that I've seen come from non-traditional hard backgrounds that prepare and temper them for what you're describing. So notwithstanding the founders, and human friction, what are the other criteria, that you use to look at before deciding, to make, or make an investment decision?
Yeah. One of the things that it really ties back into, you know, how I got into investing, finding these candidates who are kind of diamonds in the rough when I was running WAC. These, some of the founders that we find are through the strong networks that we've built outside the traditional venture areas. We have spent a lot of time in Michigan, a lot of time in Oklahoma, the mid-continent region, and the Midwest in general, fostering strong connections to try to uncover incredible founders who are maybe not getting the attention, not getting the love, or simply just not getting noticed in traditional venture, hotbeds and venture circles. That's one of the things that we've looked for, and we're proud that half our portfolio to date is from non-SF, non-New York, non-Boston based founders. And we're continuing to focus a lot of our sourcing efforts there. We think that there's amazing opportunities, not just for attractive valuations, but to find, truly generational talent that are just, they live and breathe the work ethic that we think is just so important, especially when you're an early stage founder.
I couldn't agree more. So we share a similar opinion. Our firm, we're geographic agnostic, but I also find myself gravitating to Mountain West and MidCon for that exact reason. It makes sense that you're going to have concentrations of activities in the Bay Area and metropolitan New York, but I mean, my gosh, there's amazing entrepreneurs throughout the country. Kudos to you. What stage are you investing?
So we invest in pre-seed, and we define that as idea stage through early commercialization.
Got it. And so checks cut, what's the extent that you're going to get involved with nurturing and supporting your founders?
We are prepared to be as hands-on as they need. We will not be more hands-on than they want unless the situation really requires it. And there have been times that we have had to have tough conversations with founders about making sure not to lose focus, making sure not to get distracted by every shiny object. We always lead those conversations with authenticity, but the positive conversations too, we're always there, whether it's helping with hiring, reviewing job descriptions, building, a financial model, reviewing something, customer introductions, whatever it is, we're there. I came from investment banking. I have a belief truly that this is not a truly just an allocator job. This is a client service job at the end of the day. It's my job to be good, responsible steward of LP capital, and it's my responsibility to provide value to my portfolio companies. So what does that translate to? That translates to the same kind of always on, always there, always just a phone call away availability that I learned from investment banking. And it's funny, as much as I did not want to continue to be a banker, I did learn so many incredible incredible lessons from the managing directors that I work for about what real high quality value add client service looks like. And that's something that I strive to emulate. I don't think anybody can ever, you know, maybe when I'm 25 years in the game, like those guys were, I'll be able to live up to the standard that they set. But that is the way that we approach our portfolio is we're, you know, we're teammates at the end of the day. And we think that being founder friendly is being LP friendly, and being LP friendly is being founder friendly. The only way that that, you know, equilibrium ever gets messed up is when GPs put themselves first. And our responsibility is to put ourselves last and put the folks that we partner with and who have taken you know, a tremendous amount of their time and trust and put that into us. We need to put them first before us, above all else.
And so, you know, the irony of it is your response is intuitive. You know, as I think about it, you are a steward of capital, but, you know, I think it is a really big deal for a founder to bring an investor onto its cap table. You know, dilution, you know, is more than just the money. You know, I do think it's the relationship. So good on you. I'm curious, you know, you know, these companies evolve, do you use any performance KPIs to assist assess how they're doing?
So, you know, since we invest so early, we try to keep in mind that these companies are often going to look very different. You know, that they're going to look very different in the future state. That said, what we do, and again, this is the banker in me. I was an aerospace and defense investment banker. I am allergic to business models that do not make any sense. And a lot of people say, "Hey, that's kind of strange for somebody who's in." For somebody who's in VC, but I actually think that it's a huge value add, because one of the big things that we do for every transaction that we look at, every potential investment, as we create a financial model, we're not doing anything out of control crazy, but you know, it's relatively sophisticated, and we model out the business as it has been presented to us in the materials, not the what if, not the future state, you know, whatever. We model out the business as it has been presented to us. And our number one, you know, KPI that we really, really have to look at is there a path to free cash at the end of this raise? If not, how big is that delta? Because the one thing that we will absolutely not invest in is traction now, business model some other time in the future. That's just not something that I'm going to underwrite. And you know, we partner with founders who are shooting for the moon, swinging for the fences, and are also realistic about the fact that there may have to be an off ramp where this does not turn into a venture scale opportunity, and this turns into I hate the term lifestyle business. There's nothing lifestyle about running a business. I call them just like a, you know, an operating business at normal non-venture growth, you know, software-ish margins. We consistently underwrite to make sure that the investment is going to have a path to free cash and to value as a business. You know, again, that's part of our responsibility to LPs. So we, that's the number one thing that we're really looking at is where are we on the path to free cash?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I agree with you, especially given the current interest rate environment. You know, not being at the mercy of the market or Mr. Market is great. And being at least break even goes a long way towards achieving that goal. I'm curious though, how often do you find talking to investors where they don't necessarily, or founders, excuse me, where they don't appreciate that a single or a double or a triple is actually good? You know, you may not actually turn out to be a unicorn.
You know, it's interesting. I think we've seen it with the younger founders. They recognize that they have so much operating leverage with the amount of tools that are out there that they're actually like, they're okay, because they're like, if I could get like, you know, and this is very reductive, but they're like, if I could be running this thing and, you know, I got margins at 20%, it's paying me, you know, a couple thousand dollars a month, and it's costing me, you know, 5-10 hours a week Tops, I can figure out a way to optimize that, and I'll just let that thing run in the background. These younger kids are there. It's so interesting. Their relationship to kind of they would they're okay having a 10 businesses paying them $1,000 a month, because they see the operating leverage that they get from having all of these different tools at their disposal. With some of the founders who have been around the block a little bit more, they are looking for that kind of that big exit. But at the same time, they also do recognize the value of hitting a single, because you hit a single, and if investors are not a net zero on you, chances are they'll probably see you on the next one when the idea is a little bit more baked out. So, in general, and perhaps this is just the New York ecosystem here, but founders are, at least the ones that we interface with, they're actually pretty receptive to that, to the point where actually I always need to pressure test, like, we don't want singles. We want out of the park, grand slam, home run, fish it out of the, you got to fish it out of the river, fish it out of the bay. We want that. Like, if you're just trying to hit a single, like, that's not what that is. But we do look at that floor, right? The floor has to be a reasonable single. The ceiling needs to be the longest home run in recorded history.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it earlier, shoot for the stars, hit the moon. I agree. Joe, it's been a great podcast. Before we wrap up, one of my go-tos, last questions is a retrospective. And that is, if this is going to actually be really interesting given your experience, but if you had an opportunity to go back and had a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
I would share the value of saying, I don't know. That's been one of my biggest professional unlocks, has been the power of being very vocal about not knowing something. The amount of trust that it builds, the amount of goodwill that it builds, and the amount of learning opportunities that it creates, far, far, far outweighs the kind of fear of being like, oh, what if I'm supposed to know that? And saying, I don't know, has led to some of the most meaningful and most valuable lessons I've ever learned. That's something I wish that I had learned earlier.
I guess for the benefit of everyone in our audience, I couldn't agree more. I know I've been in that boat myself, where there's some expectation. Am I supposed to know that? And I think it. I don't know anyone who knows everything. It's so, I think it makes it a lot easier to develop human connections when you're a bit vulnerable in that regard. So 100% agreed. Last question before we wrap up. If there's anyone in your network who you believe our audience would benefit listening on the Innovators and Investors podcast, who would you suggest?
In my network, I think so. One of the smartest and really most just the most intelligent and the most kind of practical, I say like a sober investor. Her name's Marit Lagasse. She's an investor at Laconia, here in New York. She is easily one of the smartest investors that I've ever met, and I think that she would be a phenomenal addition. I'm a little bit biased because she shares the same kind of like no nonsense brass tacks, it has to make sense philosophy that I do. But yes, I think that she's absolutely incredible and would be a wonderful addition, to your library.
Thank you for sharing. Our production team's going to see if we can't find Marie and ask her to accept our invite. Joe, it's been a
Absolutely.
great podcast. I genuinely appreciate your time. If any members of our audience want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Joseph Alalu on LinkedIn, and joseph@daringventures.vc. I try to be as responsive as possible, and I'm always happy to have conversations with folks who have taken a non-traditional path. Always trying to pay it forward because I got a tremendous amount of help that I certainly did not necessarily deserve from other folks too.
Oh, love it. Well, on that, thank you for sharing your time and your insights and your experience. Extremely valuable, Joe. I appreciate it. And again, for benefit of our audience, Joe Alalu. Joe is again the co-founder and general partner at Daring Ventures. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you are a successful founder or an investor would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.